Revelation 8, we return to our study of this thrilling book. After having taken a bit of a detour the past number of weeks, just to refresh our memories, we are in that third and final section which deals with the future and what will take place once the church is raptured out. So we've been looking at what will transpire during the tribulation period after the church has been removed from the earth. And up to this point, we have mainly been dealing with those events that will occur in that first 3.5 years of the seven, as the Lord Jesus Christ has taken the scroll, the book, the title deed to the earth, and is breaking its seals. Again, the first six seals are what Jesus referred to as birth pangs, the beginning of birth pangs in Matthew chapter 24, verse 8. And these six seal judgments are detailed for us in Revelation 6. And we noted from that chapter that at the very beginning of this period, a counterfeit conqueror will come onto the scene, a counterfeit Messiah, one who will captivate the world with his prowess and will help nations and empires to find a greater, if you will, global cause under his influence and leadership, even bringing such an element of unity and agreement that at least for a short time, Israel is permitted to be back in their temple and making sacrifices. And then with the breaking of the second seal, you have the destruction of war and revolution. Chapter 6, verse 4 says that John saw a second rider who was granted the ability to take peace from the earth and that men would slay one another. Then you have widespread poverty, and economic distinction, and a sort of totalitarian kind of situation and economy. With the breaking of this fourth seal, you have large-scale death as an unimaginable killing spree breaks forth with this level of crisis. You'll notice in verse 8 of that chapter, there's an ashen horse, and he who sat on it had the name Death, and Hades was following with him. Authority was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword and with famine and with pestilence and by the wild beasts of the earth. Then in conjunction with the fifth seal, you have the prayers of the martyred saints during the tribulation whose souls are under the altar and whose pleas and prayers for justice are themselves a judgment of God and the Lamb upon the earth. And we talked about how the Lord uses our prayers as a means to accomplish his end. And so we are diligent in prayer because we recognize that that is God's ordained means of accomplishing his will. And so we see these things sort of working together in that fifth seal. And then with the sixth seal, creation itself begins to unravel with cosmic and terrestrial disturbances. The earth is shaken, the text says. The sun is darkened. Moon turns red like blood. And then you have meteors or meteor showers. The atmosphere is changing. These are great signs from heaven. And so you have the beginning of the unraveling, if you will, of the natural world, which has an interesting effect on various people on the earth at that time, from the kings all the way down to the common man and the vulnerable and the needy. They know why these things are happening. In fact, all the cultures of the world will know why these things are taking place, and then that this is the wrath of the Lamb by his declaration, and yet they will refuse to cry out in humble and joyful submission. Actually, they double down in complete defiance. And though God is still, as we saw, still saving souls by the millions, there will also be an intensifying of the hardening of people's hearts as these waves of judgment come. So on the one hand, you have this amazing display of grace whereby God works among the Jews and national Israel as well as among the Gentiles as the salvation of both of these groups sort of provokes the other to greater works of grace. On the other hand, even with this display of saving grace, there is an acceleration of the hardness of hearts in others on earth at that time who want to live a life of wickedness without God. So chapter 6 ends with these bold leaders of the free world and all the way down to the everyday person, every Christ rejecter hiding in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains saying what to the mountains and rocks? Verse 16, fall on us and hide us from the presence of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of their wrath has come, and who is able to stand? So this is sort of the global sentiment at the time that God is real, Jesus Christ is real, God is in Christ, or they are the judge. We don't want to face him. That great day of the Lord has come. And so we have this question that is being asked by pagans on a global scale, who can stand? And then in chapter 7, we saw the answer to that question, that there are two groups of individuals who will be able to stand. First, there are those who have been sealed by God in the beginning of that harvest of salvation in Israel, which Paul references in Romans chapter 10 and chapter 11. Paul says there that the salvation of Gentiles will provoke Israel as a nation to jealousy and that they will turn to their Messiah. This was spoken about, of course, in the Old Testament by some of the Old Testament prophets, but Paul indicates that this will happen after the fullness of the Gentiles has come and while Israel is in a state of hardness. And yet, even in that state of hardness, there is a remnant of Jews that God is going to save, and this in Revelation 7 is the beginning of that harvest. So this is what John sees. He sees it as a group who are sealed by God. The text says 144,000 Jews, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes, and they are witnesses until God is done with them. They cannot be killed or touched until God allows. Therefore, they are at least one group who are able to stand. And so, if you will, this chapter 7 sort of answers, again, the focus of chapter 7 is really the answer to the question at the end of chapter 6. So we have this one group of sealed Jews, and then John also sees another group, one around the throne. These were tribulation saints, a countless multitude in number from every nation and all tribes and people and tongues, persevering to the end, which was also evidence of the power of God. They are the ones who do not fear. They do not fear those who were able to kill the body, but only the body. They cannot take away what has begun in these people's hearts. They cannot snuff out repentance and faith because they are God wrought. And so you have this multitude from the nations worshiping the Lord, these saints coming out of the tribulation, and again, another answer to the question, who is able to stand? This group is able to stand. They stand because they persevere in faith, and of course they persevere in faith because their faith is a gift from God, and he is the one who is upholding and sustaining their faith all along the way. Now, having seen that vision, John then resumes where we left off in chapter 6 with the sixth seal, and chapter 7 being this interlude where that question is answered. They are able to stand because of God's power, his power to protect and to care for his persecuted people, either on earth or by taking them to heaven. And so we have this break in chapter 7, but the seal judgments do not necessarily slow down. They continue to open. That is to say that this interlude is successive with the opening of the seventh seal. And what we are reminded of as we pick up in chapter 8 is that judgment still belongs to the Lamb, right? And that very first clause in verse 1 of chapter 8, when the Lamb broke the seventh seal, right? We have this reminder. That clause connecting with the previous seals, which means that these are still Christ's seals and what is to follow are also his judgments. He is the one worthy, as we mentioned back in chapter 5, the one worthy in chapter 6, the one worthy to break the seals. He is the one who has authority to give the trumpets to the angels for them to sound them. This is all part of his preparation work, right, for the setting up of his kingdom. That is to say, this seven-year tribulation period belongs to him. This is about Christ accomplishing what he wants to accomplish in his way, in his timing, to prepare for his return. And things are going to be different, right? Things that we notice already look very different than they did during his first advent when he came in humiliation to suffer and to die. His cross is now behind him. His coronation is before him. He is no longer the servant king of the Gospels. He is the King of Kings to be lauded and worshiped and honored. And in Revelation 8, he is continuing on with the next phase of preparation for his coming kingdom, which involves the next phase of his judgments. So this is it. These are his seals. These are his trumpets. He not only is the rightful heir of heaven and earth, he is also the worthy judge. And from him come this next set of devastations. And he unleashes them because judgment belongs to him. So now comes the seventh seal, and with it the seven trumpet blasts. And notice the preparation. That's really the key, I think, to understanding this section. You'll notice even down in verse 6, when we'll just cover these first six verses today, but he says even there, and the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound them. They're actually given the trumpets, but then they sort of stand at attention, ready for this to unfold, preparing themselves. And what we'll see is that there are other elements of preparation that are going on as we're sort of getting ready for these trumpet judgments. So let me just read it for us. We'll cover the first six verses for today, and then we'll pick up next time in verse 7. But there in verse 1, when the Lamb broke the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. And I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and seven trumpets were given to them. Another angel came and stood at the altar holding a golden censer, and much incense was given to him so that he might add it to the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints went up before God out of the angel's hand. And then the angel took the censer and filled it with the fire of the altar, and threw it to the earth. And there followed peals of thunder and sounds and flashes of lightning and an earthquake. And the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound them. As I said, this section is about preparation. Preparation for what? Preparation for the trumpet judgments that are about to come in chapter 8 down through chapter 11. So the idea here is that God is getting things ready, right? He's getting things ready, and everything that he does, he has a purpose in all that he does. And so what do we learn about this preparation? And I want to just point out, just to sort of hang our thoughts on these things, there are four things I want to point out regarding this preparation for the seven trumpet blasts, the seven trumpet judgments to come. And the first one is this, that there is heaven's preparation through silence. Heaven's preparation through silence. It's very interesting what happens here. Verse 1, when the Lamb broke the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. That is fascinating, right? Well, once you get to chapter 4, if you think back to those chapters we've already looked at, once you get to chapter 4, you get beyond the letters to the seven letters to the seven churches in chapters 2 and 3. You get to chapter 4 and you have these various scenes that begin to unfold, right? You have a throne standing in heaven with flashes of lightning and sounds and peals of thunder emanating, it says coming, literally emanating out of the throne. You have angelic nobles and angelic beings worshiping God. In chapter 5, you have a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice who is worthy to open the book and to break its seals. You have the apostle John himself weeping, thinking about that question, that dilemma of who is worthy to do such a thing, who is worthy to break the scroll, who is able to take the scroll out of the Father's hand. You have the angelic host singing and praising the Lamb. In chapter 6, you have the cries of the martyrs for vengeance and a powerful earthquake and creation unraveling and one judgment after the next judgment. And so you just think about, if you're just reading through this, or if you're John, you're seeing these things, all this, if you will, loudness, noise, earthquakes, proclamations, crying, weeping. You have all this sound, really, and all of this activity going on up to this point, and then you have all of a sudden 30 minutes of silence. What for? Well, there are, of course, various interpretations that have been suggested, but it is likely referring simply to the preparation that God intends to occur for these unprecedented and frightening disasters that are about to unfold. There's a sense of reverence, if you will. There's a sense of awe that these things are about to take place. That is to say, because of the nature of what is about to happen and the display of God's power in those things, it is a time to keep silent. Now, you may remember the prophet Habakkuk, who prophesied during a very dark time when justice had virtually disappeared from the land of Judah. Violence and wickedness were pervasive. You remember Habakkuk questioning God as to why he did not purge his people and restore their righteousness. But when God answered and told Habakkuk that he was going to chasten his people using the Chaldeans as his instrument, Habakkuk was even more disturbed, right? So this didn't settle the issue for him. At first it was, why aren't you purifying your people? And then the Lord says, well, I'm going to do that, but this is how I'm going to do that. And that just stirred up more questions for Habakkuk. Like, why would you use a people that are more wicked than those in Judah to chasten them? And so the Lord is hearing these questions, he's answering these questions, but in chapter 2 of Habakkuk, God makes it clear that he will judge the Chaldeans as well for their wickedness. So he's going to use the Chaldeans, or if you will, the Babylon, to bring this chastening judgment against Judah. But he is going to deal with the Chaldeans. I mean, he's going to use them as his instrument, but he's going to bring them to justice as well for their own idolatry and their own wickedness. And so he describes this in chapter 2 of how he's going to deal with the Chaldeans, and he pronounces essentially 5 woes to describe their demise and downfall. He says there in Habakkuk chapter 2, if you want to look there, chapter 2, verse 6, will not all of these take up a taunt song against him, even mockery and insinuations against him, and say, woe to him who increases what is not his for how long, and makes himself rich with loans? Drop down verse 9, woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to put his nest on high, to be delivered from the hand of calamity. Verse 12, woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and founds a town with violence. Verse 15, woe to you who make your neighbors drink, who mix in your venom even to make them drunk so as to look on their nakedness. And then he says this in verse 16, you will be filled with disgrace rather than honor. Now you yourself drink and expose your own nakedness. And again, he's talking about the Chaldeans. The cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter disgrace will come upon your glory, for the violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, and the devastation of its beasts by which you terrified them because of human bloodshed and violence done to the land, to the town and all of its inhabitants. What profit is the idol when its maker has carved it, or an image, a teacher of falsehood? For its maker trusts in his own handiwork when he fashions speechless idols. Woe to him who says to a piece of wood, awake, to a mute stone, arise. And that is your teacher? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there is no breath at all inside it. And then notice verse 20. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. So again, he's highlighting the fact that not only the violence of the Chaldeans, the treachery of the Chaldeans, but he's certainly bringing up here towards the end of the chapter this issue of idolatry, that they form these idols, that these idols are dead. They're quiet, right? They're silent. Woe, when he says, woe to him who says to a piece of wood, awake, and to a mute stone, arise. And so he's just pointing out the folly of idolatry but then says, it's sort of a play on, these idols are silent, right? You try to awaken them, but they don't say anything, right? But the Lord is in his temple. And let all the earth be silent before him. So he sort of takes this idea of the idol's inability to speak and says, I'll tell you what, they can't say anything, they're quiet, but I'll tell you what, let all the earth be quiet. Because the Lord is in his temple. The Lord is in his temple. And what is this context? Well, the context is judgment, right? It's judgment against the ungodly and woes, pronouncing of woes. So this is about the demonstration of God's power in judgment for their idolatry. And when God is in his temple, all the earth, he says, is to be silent. Sometimes you see it in other contexts, this need for silence when there is not a demonstration of God's power in judgment, but sometimes a demonstration of God's power in protection, the protection of his own people. For example, in the book of Zechariah. Again, another one of the minor prophets, if you want to turn to Zechariah. Written later than Habakkuk, Zechariah's prophecies came basically after the Jews were released from Babylon and allowed to return to their homeland, and were meant to, these prophecies were meant to encourage the people to rebuild the temple in view of the promise that someday Messiah would come to inhabit it. And so even though in Zechariah's day the people were still in a sense, oppressed or downtrodden by Gentile powers, they were instructed not to lose heart and to not forget that the Lord remembers his covenant promises to them and that he would restore and bless them. So this was a comforting word, not only to the exiles of Zechariah's day, but also to the remnant of God's chosen people in that future day, right before the coming of that messianic kingdom. And so you have a context of God's judgment, his power in judgment, and then in this case, a context, the context of God's power in protection and restoration. And notice what it says in chapter 2, Zechariah 2, verse 1. Then I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, there was a man with a measuring line in his hand. So I said, where are you going? And he said to me, to measure Jerusalem, to see how wide it is and how long it is. And behold, the angel who was speaking with me was going out, and another angel was coming out to meet him and said to him, run, speak to that young man, saying, Jerusalem will be inhabited without walls because of the multitude of men and cattle within it. For I, declares the Lord, will be a wall of fire around her, and I will be the glory in her midst. Ho there, flee from the land of the north, declares the Lord, for I have dispersed you as the four winds of the heavens, declares the Lord. Ho, Zion, escape, you who are living with the daughter of Babylon, for thus says the Lord of hosts, after glory he has sent me against the nations which plunder you, for he who touches you touches the apple of his eye. For behold, I will wave my hand over them so that they will be plunder for their slaves, and then you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me. Sing for joy and be glad, O daughter of Zion, for behold, I am coming, and I will dwell in your midst, declares the Lord. Many nations will join themselves to the Lord in that day and will become my people. And then I will dwell in your midst, and you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you. The Lord will possess Judah as his portion in the Holy Land and will again choose Jerusalem. Be silent, verse 13, all flesh before the Lord, for he is aroused from his holy habitation. So again, what you have here in Zechariah, and this happens a lot in this particular prophecy, where you have sort of this, if you will, a near fulfillment, where clearly he's speaking to the people of Zechariah's day. He's telling them about making references to, again, their return from captivity. And again, Zechariah is trying to encourage them and motivate them to be steadfast in this rebuilding of the temple, this particular project. But then along the way, these chapters sort of transition into something that is clearly not intended to be fulfilled in Zechariah's day. And so you go from basically this sort of near fulfillment to this future fulfillment. Of course, these references to the Lord being in their midst, verse 11, the many nations that will be joining themselves to the Lord in that day. Again, these all reference what we've just been looking at in Revelation chapter 7, right? This great act of amazing grace in God saving a multitude from the nations, and then his purging and purifying work among his own people, the sealing of these Jews, and all this preparatory work that will then lead into the establishment of Christ's kingdom on earth. So again, you have a call for silence in view of God's power, but in this case, as the Lord is aroused to defend Zion from her enemies. And so again, you have context where it's the Lord bringing judgment against the nations, or in even some case against his own people for their idolatry. But then you have other contexts where God is reassuring his people that he is caring for them, that he is protecting them, that he will deliver them ultimately, and that he will be their God, that they will be his people. And in that context as well, there's this call for silence, right? A call for silence in view of the fact that the Lord, in this case, is the reason it's termed the Holy Land is not because the land is holy per se, it's because the Lord is there, right? At this point, the Lord is in the land, right? Which is what makes it the Holy Land. And so this is sort of what's going on, I think, in Revelation chapter 8. You have a scene in chapter 8 of Revelation in which the Lord is aroused, right? God and the Lamb are meeting out judgment. And at the same time, as we noted in chapter 7, protecting and preserving the people of God, whether they be the Jewish remnant or those saved from among the nations. And then we have this brief period of silence, which, again, is significant in contrast to the constant noise and activity of the first six seal judgments. And again, it's preparatory in nature. It prepares us for these additional judgments. It's as if to say more is coming, and what is coming is going to be more intense. It's going to be more intense than what we've already seen and what John had already seen in vision in chapter 6. And this is a pattern in Revelation. Interruptions in the action or special announcements about what lies ahead. You'll notice down in chapter 8, verse 13, it says, "Then I looked and I heard an angel flying in the mid-heaven saying with a loud voice, 'Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth because of the remaining blasts of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound.'" Again, there's this sort of break in this announcement that more is coming. More is coming, so get ready. You see it in Revelation chapter 10, verse 5, "Then the angel whom I saw standing on the sea and on the land lifted up his right hand to heaven and swore by him who lives forever and ever, who created heaven and the things in it, and the earth and the things in it, and the sea and the things in it, that there will be delay no longer. But in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he is about to sound, then the mystery of God is finished, as he preached to his servants and his servants the prophets." So you have this announcement that there is to be no more delay and to prepare for the mystery of God's judgment to be finished. Then you have in chapter 15 another scene of reverent worship. Verse 8 says, "And the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his power. And no one was able to enter the temple until the seven plagues of the seven angels were finished." Which is just another scene to prepare you for the bowls, in that text, the bowls of wrath. Or you could think about it this way. There is a scene in chapters 4 and 5 to prepare us for the seals. Okay, the scene of the throne and the scene of the Lamb prepares us for the seals. There is another scene here in chapter 8 to prepare us for the trumpets, and then another to prepare us for the bold judgments. So that's sort of that's the pattern that will unfold for us as we sort of move along. So this is what you have here at the beginning of chapter 8. Everyone is in awe, and everyone is fastening their seat belts for an intensifying display of God's wrath, an intensification in the severity and the specificity of judgments. So heaven is preparing for such things, and it does so through 30 minutes of silence. So just think about John. I mean, it isn't like John just like got a memo in vision that said there's going to be 30 minutes. It's like he's actually experiencing this 30 minutes of silence. 30 minutes is a long time when it's totally quiet, right? So he's seeing all this action, all this judgment, all these calamities, and all of a sudden there's a half hour of silence. And he's, if you will, experiencing this in vision, this just pause, right, as heaven prepares for what's to come. A second, we also see the seven angels' preparation through readiness, verse 2, and I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and seven trumpets were given to them. All right, now we already have had angels, right? We've come across plenty of angels in this prophecy. We've seen a strong angel. We've had the phrase many angels. We've had a section that spoke about four angels. But this here seems to be a distinct group of angelic beings. You'll notice the definite article, the seven angels. And so some have referred to them as the presence angels. And they do that because they are seen standing before God in his presence and have been there for some time. And so these are those who by sort of description, they are those who stand before him. And again, that's a unique way of describing these particular angelic beings. They are those who stand before him, and they are also prepared to do what God intends to do in this next phase of judgment. Again, we don't know why. We don't know why God chooses to use these specific angels for this specific purpose, but these will be his instruments for this particular task. They receive seven trumpets, and as verse 6 indicates, they will prepare themselves to sound them, which will lead to unique expressions of judgment, all unfolding out of the seventh seal. So this seventh seal judgment is a group of seven more specific expressions. This is something we have put up there several weeks ago. This seventh seal is a group of seven more specific expressions of wrath. And so you have six seals, and then the seventh seal, when it is opened, has these seven trumpets, which are the expression of the seventh seal. Right? They are the expressions of God's wrath, like the seven seals coming in succession and directed at the wicked upon the earth in those days. So these angels will sound their trumpets, out of which will come the Lamb's wrath in these new demonstrations, in these new expressions of judgment. Thirdly, all right, the third thing we see is the saints' preparation through petitions. The saints' preparation through petitions. Verse 3, another angel came and stood at the altar, holding a golden censer, and much incense was given to him so that he might add it to the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar, which was before the throne. So you have another angel. It's not one of the seven angels of verse 2. And it's not Jesus, although some commentators have tried to say that this particular messenger is Christ. The reason that they sort of gravitate to that idea is because of what the angel does. This angel's particular involvement with the prayers of the saints, and so they sort of, if you will, kind of tie into some of the teaching of the book of Hebrews and the fact that Christ is the one who intercedes. He is the mediator between God and man. And so they kind of go that particular direction, although the text says another angel there at the beginning of verse 3, and the word for another, the word in the Greek just simply means one of the same kind. And so it's just saying another angel. It's not saying an angel of a different kind. It's just saying here's another one, right? And so I think that alone, it makes it difficult to get there. If you think this is referencing Christ and his ministry, although there are clearly some similarities there with, again, what you find in the book of Hebrews, but that very phrase alone, another angel, I think dismisses that idea. And so you have this other angel who comes and stands at the altar, and he is holding a golden censer. And we know what that is, right? This is the image of the altar of incense, right? The censer being the pan that was used in the Old Testament to transport the fiery coals from the brazen altar, which was outside the holy place, to the altar of incense inside the holy place, but just outside the Holy of Holies, where God's glory dwelt. And so if you had just took a sort of a picture of the layout of the tabernacle and temple, they would take this the coals from this out here in the courtyard area, this altar of burnt offering. In the morning and in the evening, the priest would take the coals from this altar into the holy place, this being the veil between the holy place and the Holy of Holies, but would take it to this particular altar of incense. And so what you see as you go through the book of Revelation is you see this imagery of what's going on in heaven, right? In vision, John sees different elements like this. So we've seen lampstands, right? We've seen lampstands. Here we have a reference to the altar of incense. And again, just tying into some of the things that we learn and read about in the Old Testament. And so this in John's vision is the heavenly counterpart to the altar of incense in the temple. And it's the same golden incense altar seen by Isaiah in Isaiah 6 and in Ezekiel chapter 10 in their respective visions. But again, it's not the first time that we have encountered an altar in this prophecy. You'll remember back in chapter 6, the fifth seal, right? You had an altar, and underneath that altar, the souls of those who had been slain for their stand on God's word and their testimony of faith in Christ. And again, what were they crying out for? In that context, what were the souls under the altar crying out for? They were crying out for vengeance, right? For vindication. Saying, and this is what the text says there, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, will you refrain from judging and avenging our blood on those who dwell on the earth?" Verse 11 of that chapter says this, "And there was given to each of them a white robe, and they were told they should rest for a little while longer until the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who were to be killed, even as they had been, would be completed also." So you remember when we went through that, there's this sort of like rest because the total number of martyrs has not come in, right? And so what you have here is incense or the smoke from the incense itself being likened to the prayers of God's people, which makes sense, right? This idea is expressed in Psalm 141, verse 2, where David prays to the Lord, "May my prayer be counted as incense before you, the lifting up of my hands as the evening offering." So when you get to Revelation chapter 8, verse 3, what we find are more believers being persecuted and more martyrs dying and their prayers ascending. And they are added, those prayers are added to the prayers of those who died earlier in this 3.5-year period of the tribulation. And these prayers become, in a way, the conduit for this next series of judgments. You remember we said the prayers that happened back in the fifth seal were the means by which God would these judgments would unfold, right? Well, here we go again. More persecution, more martyrs, more prayers, and then guess what's coming now? These judgments that were before, wait for it. It's like, here they come, right? And again, they're going to come in rapid succession. And so these prayers become sort of the means for this next series of judgments. And so the saints prepare, if you will, with their petitions, their prayers. Their petitions are before God in His presence. Verse 4, "And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints went up before God out of the angel's hand." So now you have more martyrs, those that have been added since the fifth seal judgment, those who have gone all the way to the end, those with, again, as we've said, they have enduring faith, they have persevered. Therefore, you have more petitions, and you have more vindication of God's glory and His power to save as well as to judge. That is to say, the smoke and the prayers rise before God, and God hears their cries and responds to their cries. Now, why is that significant? Well, we already sort of pointed this out back in chapter 6, but it's worth reemphasizing that with all of this turmoil, right, in the middle of all of the turmoil and the chaos and the upheaval, you cannot imagine that God has forgotten about His people and their plight. So it's this sort of a reminder that even in the midst of these things that are just seem to be coming, one after the next, and with all of the loudness and with all the noise and with all of the catastrophes, you have in the sort of in the midst of all of that, you have, hold it, 30 minutes of silence. It's like this awe and reverence as they stand and they wait for this to unfold. And then also, as all this stuff is happening, you have this reminder that even in the midst of all of that chaos and calamity, God never forgets His people. In other words, it's almost as if to say, don't get caught up now in all of that judgment and think that God, for one moment, just because the Lord seems so intensely focused on bringing His wrath against the ungodly, God doesn't, in the process of doing that, ever take His eye off of His people. He doesn't ever forget their prayers, right? God is never blind to their suffering and pain. He is never ignorant of their weaknesses and vulnerabilities. He never forgets what they have endured. Every moment of persecution, every slanderous word spoken against them, God attends to every need and watches over them. And when the smoke and the prayers go up, when they go up for the vindication of God's glory and the blood of the saints, they go up for the establishment of justice and the bringing in of God's kingdom, our Father receives them all. He receives all those prayers. And He answers them according to His wisdom and might. It's as if they've been collected, right? That's kind of the idea. It's like these prayers and petitions have been collected, and God hasn't forgotten. It hasn't been the right timing, right? So He's been very mindful of them. And so just to say this, folks, that when you pray, you may be in the midst of chaos and turmoil and some pretty disturbing things in your life right now, or you may have experienced some very chaotic and disturbing things. And in those times, either in the past or even in the present, when you're praying to God and you're petitioning God, just remember that in the midst of all that, the Lord hears. And you may not see that direct, immediate answer from God right then, but God hasn't forgotten. He hasn't forgotten the persecution. He hasn't forgotten the affliction. He hasn't forgotten your weakness. God is collecting those petitions, and He will answer them because He's good. And He can answer them because He's powerful, right? So He will because of His goodness and His knowledge, His infinite wisdom, but He can because He has the power to do it. And so it's just this reminder that God is the one who hears, He is the one who receives our petitions, He is the one who answers them, but He always does so in His perfect timing. And in this particular case, He answers them speedily and certainly. Because right behind this, it's like you get this statement about these prayers, but then it's like immediately, here it comes, right? And that brings us to this final idea, and that is this: creation's preparation through wonders. Creation's preparation through wonders. Verse 5, then the angel took the censer and filled it with the fire of the altar and threw it to the earth. Again, this is a swift and decisive response to the prayers of God's people. And it goes on, there followed peals of thunder and sounds and flashes of lightning and an earthquake. Now, in light of verse 1, think back to verse 1. What is so obvious about this verse? It's not silent anymore. The silence is over, okay? We had 30 minutes, right? A half hour of silence, a silence of awe and admiration. But that silence of awe and admiration gives way to peals of divine thunder and lightning and a violent shaking of the whole earth again, because we've already had one great earthquake in the sixth seal. But here you have another, and creation itself is responding to this additional display of God's power. That is to say, it is reacting, the creation is reacting to the Creator. Even as, Paul says, even as it groans and suffers and waits for God's final redemption, even as these judgments are unfolding in preparation for King Jesus to set up his kingdom, the earth prepares with violent clashes and crashes of its own. And that is what John sees in this vision. It's what he sees in this scene. Heaven is prepared. Angels are prepared. They've been given trumpets, but they ready themselves for this thing that is about to come. Prayers, if you want to think of it, prayers are instrumentally prepared. The reason, part of the reason why these judgments are coming is these judgments are an answer to the petitions and prayers of the saints for vindication, right? So prayers are instrumentally prepared, and then here, creation itself prepares with flashes of lightning, shifting of land masses, and thunderous noises when this one angel throws fire to the earth in preparation for the seven angels to sound their trumpets. As if to say, Lord, do it. Lord, do it. Bring this. Bring this. Again, this is all because every believer in our hearts cries out for this. We want all things to be made new, right? We want all things to be made right. We want the curse of sin to be dealt with, right? And that's what this is all about. It's about Christ redeeming these things. And so as all of these various things, groups, individuals, prayers, as all these things prepare, it's as if to say, Lord, do this. It's time, right? Accomplish these things. These are the judgments that belong to the Lamb. Seven seal judgments. And then next time we'll pick up in verse 7 with the trumpets, right? Which will be even more intense and more destructive. It's hard to imagine, but it's true. And so we will again, as this seventh seal comes, it's sort of within that. I think of it sort of like as a sort of a telescope, if you will, like contained within this seventh seal are the remaining judgments to come. So as this seventh seal is broken by the Lamb, we go immediately into this section. As we said, in the next few chapters, we'll be looking at each of these seals, and then each of these trumpets, and then when we get to the seventh trumpet, it'll be very similar. As that seventh trumpet blast comes, then the seven bowls of wrath come with that, and so one comes right out of the other in that sequence. So we'll look at those things. But be encouraged, folks. Be encouraged, right? Especially about the fact that, again, in our lives, there is some turmoil and chaos every once in a while. And in the midst of that, don't be faithful to go to the Lord in prayer. And understand God is faithful himself. And even though you may not see that immediate response on his part, God is not forgotten. And God will preserve. God will protect. It doesn't always mean that God's going to spare your life. Again, God doesn't just protect his people by preserving their physical lives. Sometimes he protects and cares for his people by taking them to heaven, right? And so all these things are in God's hands, but we need to be mindful of his power and his faithfulness. All right, folks, we'll stop there. We'll come back next time.